Good morning. That was, it's been such an exciting service so far. Interesting challenges. Our reading this morning is from one of the oldest texts in the world, which I was reminded of by an email that M.A. sent me, mentioning the death of Herbert Mason, been a professor at the university Mark attended, M.A. attended, and he had done a well-known translation of the Epic of Gilgamesh. So, this is a text that comes from approximately 3,000 years before the Common Era, at least 1,500 years before the time of the Iliad and the Odyssey. It was recorded in cuneiform letters. It's a system of wedge-shaped marks made in wet clay with a reed stylus. This version is from Sumerian, one of the ancient languages of Mesopotamia. But similar versions exist in nearly every language from throughout the ancient Near East, making the Epic of Gilgamesh not only one of the world's oldest pieces of literature, but also the first international bestseller. He who has seen everything, I will make known to the lands. I will teach about him who experienced all things alike. Anu granted him knowledge of everything. A little closer? Yeah. I'm gonna do a little bit of rearranging here. I think I usually have it on the other side. Let's see if I can make that fit a little better. How's that? Is our volume loud enough?
Okay. That's good.
Is it good? Okay. Let's see if we can make all this arrangement work. Good. Okay. Anu granted him knowledge of everything. He saw the secret, discovered the hidden. He brought us information of the time before the flood. He went on a distant journey, pushing himself to exhaustion, but then was brought to peace. He carved on a stone the story of his toils and built the wall of Uruk Haven, the wall of a sacred Ayana temple, the holy sanctuary. The city of Uruk, at its height, had between 20 and 50,000 inhabitants within its walls. This may not seem like much to us today, but in its time, it was the largest city that had ever existed, a place of unprecedented human density and complexity, dazzling to any first-time visitor. Look at its wall, which gleams like copper. Inspect its inner wall, the likes of which no one can equal. Touch the threshold stone. It dates from ancient times. Ancient times. People were already thinking of ancient times. Right? Approach the Ayana temple, the residence of Ishtar, such as no later king or man ever equaled. Go up on the wall of Uruk and walk around. Examine its foundation. Inspect its brickwork thoroughly. Is not the inner wall made of kiln-fired brick? And did not the seven sages themselves lay out its plans? Well, I don't know who these sages might have been, but someone sure did a good job with city planning, at least according to the epic's description. Here it comes. One-third city. One-third lowlands, and the open area, one-third palm gardens, and the open area of the Ishtar temple, the wall of Uruk encloses. That is sweet. Part city, part garden, part open space with monuments. I wonder if they had outdoor concerts, what kind of music they played. I wonder what music Matt has prepared for us. Thank you. Matt, thank you so much time for going to the library and researching Sumerian music. It's amazing how familiar that sounded, isn't it? I feel like I've heard it before. Well, gardens, parks, temples. As the description of the city continues, we learn that even though not much has been written yet besides this story and some merchants' records and some mathematical problems, Uruk even has a library of sorts. Find the copper tablet box, open its lock of bronze, undo the fastening of its secret opening, take out and read from the tablet how Gilgamesh went through every hardship. Supreme over other kings, lordly in appearance, he is the hero born of Uruk. He walks out in front, the leader, and walks at the rear, trusted by his companions. So even after 5,000 years, we can learn from these lines. Sometimes you lead from the front, and other times it's best to lead from the rear, from right among your fellow travelers. Mighty net, protector of his people, raging flood wave who destroys even walls of stone. Gilgamesh is strong to perfection. Gilgamesh is awesome to perfection. It was he who opened the mountain passes, who dug wells on the flank of the mountain. It was he who crossed the ocean, the vast seas, to the rising sun, who explored the world regions seeking life. It was he who reached by his own sheer strength Utnapishtim, the far away, who restored for humankind the sanctuaries that the flood had destroyed. Who can compare with him in kingliness? Who can say, like Gilgamesh, I am king? Whose name from the day of his birth was called Gilgamesh? 2/3 of him is God. 1/3 of him is human. What more could you want? Gilgamesh himself is just like his city, three parts gloriously put together, awesome in the proper sense of that word. What more could anyone possibly want? You should know that there was a real King Gilgamesh, a real human being. The Sumerian king list tells us that he was the 5th king of the 7th dynasty to rule the region of the city of Uruk. But the Gilgamesh of our story is more than a human king. He's 2/3 God and 1/3 human. And he's also 100% dissatisfied with his life. Suddenly, at the height of his power, he's troubled with terrible restlessness. He walks around the enclosure of Uruk. Like a wild bull, he makes himself mighty, head raised over others. There's no rival who can raise his weapon against him. There's no one to fight, no one to struggle with, no challenge to hold his interest. His lack of purpose begins to express itself in a series of aggressive sexual encounters with whomever he can find. Today we might call this a sex addiction, but it's backed by power, and that makes this something much more dangerous. Gilgamesh does not leave a son to his father, day or night. Gilgamesh does not leave a girl to her mother, the daughter of the warrior, the bride of the young man. The people are appalled by the change in the king. They begin saying things like this in the street. Is Gilgamesh the shepherd of Uruk Haven? Is he our shepherd? Bold, eminent, knowing, wise? In Uruk, 5,000, as in the U.S., 5,000 years later, stinging words are the people's weapon against feeling totally overwhelmed. And undoubtedly, sometimes those stinging words might go a little too far. But that's what you got when the times are bad. They confer among themselves. And the gods confer among themselves. And they decide that what Gilgamesh needs is a fit companion. Someone who'll be a match for him in vitality and power. They bring forth Enkidu. Gilgamesh is God and human. Enkidu is human and animal. He appears full grown in the wilderness, living among wild beasts like Tarzan. He's huge and powerful, and the epic makes sure that we know that he had great hair. His whole body was shaggy with hair. He had a full head of hair like a woman. His locks billowed in profusion. He knew neither people nor settled living. He ate grasses with the gazelles, and his thirst was slaked with mere water, that is, not beer. No clothes, no house, no bread, and finally, no beer. Here is a wild man. Beer was first brewed in Sumeria and enjoyed by almost everyone in the city, so to not drink beer was to be not quite civilized. There are other things about human life with which Enkidu is completely unacquainted, but that's all about to change. A trapper begins working the wilderness area where Enkidu roams. Enkidu frees all the animals from his snares. He then confronts the trapper face to face at the watering hole, and the man flees home in terror. He goes to Gilgamesh, carrying on about how he has encountered the strongest fellow in the world, a wild man who will not let him make a civilized living. This gets the king's attention. Strongest fellow in the world, you say? We'll see about that. He calls for Shamhat, a courtesan priestess from the great temple, and asks her to accompany the trapper back to the wilderness. He tells her that when she sees the wild man, she should disrobe and stand naked before him, and then bring him back to the city. That's how Enkidu meets her, and he is trapped. Shamhat likes him too, what with all that great hair. They make love for 6 days and 7 nights. And now Enkidu wants to return to the woods and fields and kick up his heels with his animal buddy. Zippity-doo-dah, I feel good. But the animals want nothing to do with him. He's changed. He's not one of them anymore. All he can do now is go back to Shamhat and ask her advice. What now? He feels diminished, but she says, no, your time with me has improved you. You are wise now and beautiful. You've become like a god. Why do you want to run around with wild animals? Now, all this may sound familiar to anyone who has seen a teenage boy transformed by his first serious girlfriend. Shamhat urges him to come back with her to Uruk. He agrees, and on the way she tells him about Gilgamesh, how powerful he is, and how he's lately become dangerous and out of control. Enkidu vows that he will challenge Gilgamesh to fight and knock some sense into him. She says, don't be so sure, but come on, let's go. She gives him half of her clothing to cover himself, and they're off. They stop halfway to eat with some shepherds. This is Enkidu's first exposure to bread, which he finds delicious, and to beer, of which he drinks 7 jugs at once. He starts singing loudly and swinging his weapons, and he continues on with Shamhat. Meanwhile, Gilgamesh has been having dreams that foretell the coming of Enkidu. He sees a meteor on the ground and suddenly feels moved to embrace it, quote, like a wife. At Gilgamesh, men, women, meteors. Next, he dreams of a mighty axe outside of his bedroom door, and this too he embraces passionately. Careful, big guy, it's sharp! But when Gilgamesh shares the dreams with his mother, she tells him that both axe and meteor must represent the coming of a friend, as mighty as the god king is himself. Enkidu arrives in the city and challenges Gilgamesh to fight. There's an epic smackdown in the public square between these two, like the World Wrestling Federation on more than the usual steroids. God, man, and manimal, both are twice as tall as normal human beings. The walls tremble as they battle to a standstill. But at the end, they embrace and become fast friends, each of them delighted to have at last found an equal. They combine forces. Some people have called this the first bromance. The next step is to find an opponent worthy of facing both heroes at once. This they find in the form of Humbaba. Humbaba. You find a better name than that for a monster, and the next cup of coffee is on me, since I don't drink beer, which goes along with all the great hair. Humbaba means hugeness. And he guards a forest of great cedar trees far to the west in what's today's country of Lebanon. Enkidu has seen him before and warns Gilgamesh fearfully, Humbaba is a terror to human beings. Humbaba's roar is a flood, his mouth is fire, and his breath is death. He can hear 100 leagues away any rustling in his forest. Who would go down to his forest? The gods assigned him as a terror to human beings, and whoever goes down to his forest, paralysis will strike. Gilgamesh will not be dissuaded. He orders weapons for him and his partner, axes that weigh 180 pounds each, 120-pound swords, giant bows, thick armor. But will it be heavy enough to withstand Humbaba? Just to be sure, the pair perform various prayers and religious sacrifices, lining up as many gods and goddesses as they can to they can persuade to be on their side. Nearing Humbaba's forest, it's Gilgamesh's turn to be afraid. But Enkidu says, come on, buddy, we can do this. Finally, they're ready. They cut down a cedar, which brings Humbaba breathing blasts of fire. The two heroes take their positions, but suddenly Humbaba starts to speak. First, he tries to gain their pity. Hey, you guys, I never had a mother to love me or a father for a role model. I'm all alone here. This doesn't work. So he tries dividing the comrades, saying to Gilgamesh, come on, king, you can have all the trees you want. I'll build you a palace and be your servant. Lose this hairy guy, and I'll be your new best friend. Gilgamesh ponders for a moment. I wonder. At Gilgamesh, meteors, axes, monsters. But Enkidu tells him, stand your ground. Gilgamesh snaps out of it and strikes. Turns out that the gods have been watching this exciting episode all along. Now they raise a wind to help the heroes, and down goes Humbaba as the mountains and forests tremble. They cut off his head and offer it in sacrifice to the gods. Of course, they look a mess after all this, so they stop to clean up by the Euphrates River. Gilgamesh washes the blood and gore out of his hair, puts on clean clothes, and then sets the crown back on his head. And now, looking down from heaven, the goddess Ishtar sees him. And she is smitten. And that's the end of episode one. You'll have to wait until next Sunday for the next episode, like I used to wait for Star Trek, The Next Generation, back in the 80s, when I was serving full-time in an old Universalist church. Once service was over, when the coffee hour or the potluck and perhaps some odd meetings, I would step out of the stained glass filtered light into the world outside and softly start to sing, I was rejoicing in my heart that soon it would be time. Everyone who knows the show has their favorite episode, I think. Is that true? Okay. Mine is one called Darmok. The Enterprise has been hailed by an alien vessel whose captain comes on screen to speak with Captain Picard. The computer's translator program can handle the alien words, but no one can make sense of them. Shaka, when the walls fell. Timba, his arms wide. Well, clearly, the aliens and their captain are frustrated too. Finally, the alien captain, played by the great Paul Winfield, ponders for a moment, and then he seems to come to a decision. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. His ship's superior technology whisks Picard off of the Enterprise. And suddenly he finds himself on the surface of a nearby planet facing the alien captain, who holds two daggers and offers one to Picard, saying over and over again, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. But taking this for a challenge, Picard says, no, I won't fight you. But that's not the captain's idea, not the alien captain's idea. He continues in person now to recite phrase after phrase. Each one seems to be the title of a scene from a story. Shaka, when the walls fell. So-and-so on the ocean, and so on. And then Darmok and Jalad again. Picard begins to understand that these people communicate entirely by references to certain stories, some historical and some mythical, perhaps. But he still doesn't know what the stories are. At moments, the other captain seems exasperated. It's like groping for the right way to get through to a child. And then another figure enters the scene, a monster that attacks them both. They fight it together and drive it away, but the alien captain is gravely injured. Sitting with him now, with his injured new friend, Picard slowly pieces it together that Darmok and Jalad must be two mythic rivals who join forces to face a monster at a place called Tanagra. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, exclaims the other captain, delighted at this breakthrough. Even as his life ebbs away, he's joyful. Now, using image and gesture, he asks Picard to please share a story of his own, a story from home that's meaningful to people like him. Picard chooses the story of Gilgamesh and Enkidu, with its strong resemblance to the Darmok story, and yes, to the new story he has just enacted with this dear new friend, who dies now with a smile of satisfaction on his kind alien face. Later, back on the Enterprise, he describes with wonder how the other captain was willing to sacrifice his life to make this bond of stories between one people and another. They've shared a common danger, yes. You could even say that they shared a common enemy. But that's all part of something bigger. To share stories together, person to person, or people to people, is even more essential than to share a common language. Are stories built from language, or is language built from stories? Perhaps each is made from both. Children acquire language in many ways, but storytelling is one of the most essential. They may not know all the words, but they still get the story through pictures, gestures, feelings, and the very body of the storyteller. The body of stories. Your body. My body. The more we know of another person's stories or another people's, the less easy it is to ignore them, to discount them, to disown them, or to let them die. To make targets, victims, or prisoners of storytellers, of story-bearing bodies, is no easy thing to do if we know their stories and if they know ours too. Even if we don't know each other's language and it all sounds like Oonga Boonga or Bunka Wunka at first, that will change in time, but only if we make it so, like Picard always says. The Star Trek episodes ends without any mention of an afterlife. We don't know if the alien captain or his people believe in one. Neither do we know if Picard and his crew believe in some kind of persistence, of some kind of soul, once a storyteller's body has died, or if this is a notion that's been left behind in the distant past. And that's where we've left Gilgamesh and Enkidu. To find out more, tune in next Sunday, same time, same place, to catch the next episode. See you then.
Mm-hmm.